and welcome to the Science Podcast for June 13th, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, a special podcast to go with our special section on forests in the magazine. We'll hear about preserving forest biodiversity, seed dispersal and tree resilience, being a tropical forest ecologist, and genetics and growth of an ancient date seed. All this plus a late-breaking story about leaves from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
So in the news, what we tried to do was look at how people impact forests.
Science's Elizabeth Panisi edited the news portion of a special section on forests in this week's Science.
We have three stories, each from a different part of the world, each reflecting sort of a different point in time in terms of what humans are doing in terms of destroying forests, fixing forests, or letting them just grow back on their own.
Which three places in particular did you look at?
So we looked at the Democratic Republic of the Congo in Africa. We looked at Brazil, and we looked at an area in China, actually the area where the earthquake was, in Sichuan Province.
Let's start with the Democratic Republic of Congo. What's happening there? That's a rather large rainforest area, isn't it?
That's right. It's second in size only to the Amazon in Brazil. And it's relatively untouched, or has been relatively untouched, particularly in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, in part because of transportation issues. It's hard to get to the forest. It's hard to get the logs out of the forest. And also there's been a lot of turmoil in the country, so things have been fairly disrupted. So that forest has been in relatively good shape. But what's happening now is the country is moving forward. There's a lot of pressure from Asia, in particular China, to get those timber resources, and a lot of development going on, a lot of new roads being put in. And so what our story looks at is sort of the situation as it stands now and how people are trying to keep track and maybe protect this large area of rainforest.
So it's demand for exports that's really driving the conversion of the rainforest there?
It's actually both. It's demand for exports, but as our story points out, there's also a huge demand for firewood and charcoal locally. And that actually puts a bigger burden on the forest than the actual lumber being exported.
Well, who's doing the logging then in those areas? Is it primarily industrial organizations, or is it people who are slashing and burning in order to get that firewood and charcoal?
There's all three going on. There's a lot of what they call freelance logging operations, which is basically someone going out in a chainsaw and just taking out what he or she can carry.
So what are scientists doing to examine the Congo Basin area?
So one of the big problems in this part of the world has been difficulties in monitoring what's actually happening in the forest. In Brazil, for example, there are great satellite images tracking through time how the forest has been destroyed and how much is being lost. In this part of the world, for one thing, often it's not clear cutting but selective logging, which means that it's harder to pick up by the satellite imaging. But there's also been a dearth of satellite data for this part of the world. What's happening now is there are researchers and international organizations that are trying to make it possible to do better monitoring of what's going on. Recently, there's been a map published that shows what happened during the 90s that gives people an idea of just where the destruction is going on, and it's going on primarily along roads and along rivers and in the border by Uganda. So it gives, with this satellite data and new satellite data that will be coming online, they'll be able to track what's going on. At the same time, there are some efforts to establish what they call landscapes, which are areas that are designated for conservation. Whether these landscapes will be preserved is something we'll find out.
Well, let's turn to a more deforested rainforest now, Brazil. What's happening there?
Well, of course, many people focus on the slash and burn agriculture and the problems that are occurring because of the clear cutting of the primary rainforest. What our story looks at is what happens after the farmers have moved on. A lot of times, after a while, the clear-cut fields will be abandoned and new forests will grow. That's called a secondary forest. Elsewhere, companies will set up tree plantations, and so they'll grow one species of trees, often eucalyptus. And what researchers are trying to do is figure out what happens to biodiversity when you have a secondary forest or when you have a tree plantation. Do the birds and the lizards and frogs that thrived in the old growth forest and the original rainforest, do they just move over, or do they disappear, or do new species come in? And so our story takes a look at that question.
Well, in these secondary forests, how much of the biodiversity is coming back, or is it all coming back?
It depends on what kinds of animals and plants you're talking about. As we discussed in our news story, there's been a big research project that was set up over a large private landholding where there is secondary forest, there's tree plantations, and also a lot of the primary forest still there. And what they did is they compared what species of birds and how many species of birds were in the three different types of habitats, and amphibians and plants and all sorts of insects. And what they find is sometimes the habitat doesn't make that big a difference, and sometimes it makes a huge difference. So, for example, birds, there were 40% of the old growth forest birds were found in the secondary forest. Only 20% of them were found in the plantations. I think orchid bees did almost as well in the secondary forest and the plantations as they did in the primary forest.
And we're not talking sheer numbers here. We're actually talking about species, right? This is actually cutting down on the number of species that can even live in these second growth forests.
That's right. And that's one reason why many people feel it's so important to preserve the primary rainforest, because not everything can just move over into a secondary rainforest.
Are there alternative approaches to maintain the semblance of an old growth forest so that these species can continue to survive?
Yes. What you can do and what's being advocated and done on at least a small scale is something called selective logging, where you go in and you take out some of the trees, but not all of the trees. What's important to many of these species is not necessarily the old growth forest per se, but the structure of the forest, where you have tall trees and short trees and understory. And if you maintain the structure by keeping some of each size tree, then the species will do better.
Are there any species that are actually helped by the deforestation?
Yeah, grasshoppers apparently did really well.
Okay. Let's turn now to China. How are the species adapting there, given how China treats its forests?
Well, in at least one particular region of China, the Sichuan province, the government has really worked hard to sort of help protect and restore the forests that are in those regions. It happens to be the area where the world's most diverse temperate forests are. So there's a lot of endemic species, a lot of key animals that are found nowhere else, the panda being one of them. So in the 70s and through the 90s even, these forests were being cut down at a rapid rate. But it caused problems, and in 1981 and then again in 1998, there were two floods of the Yangtze River that were blamed partially on the lack of forest cover. So in 1998, the Sichuan province banned logging, and the Chinese government also put restrictions on logging and established a program that encouraged farmers to grow trees on land that had steep slopes on it. Over the past 10 years, those programs have been quite successful in helping to restore these forests. In addition, 15% of the Sichuan province was set aside in national parks and preserves to help protect what forest was remaining.
Now, what happens when the ban runs out on logging? Will these parks, for example, be protected forever?
Well, this is the good question. There are concerns because the demand for lumber in China is huge, and the pressure to log these areas is also huge. So the Chinese government is considering extending the ban and also extending the program where they pay farmers to grow trees on their steep slopes as a way of maintaining these forests. But the ban runs out in 2010, so we'll have to wait and see just what will happen then.
Other than the ban, are the parks having the intended effects?
The parks have been almost too successful.
How so?
Well, there are thousands and thousands of people visit them, especially during the national holidays. And all those people make for trampled areas. And for a while, for example, you stopped seeing pandas in some of these parks where you used to see them. There were just too much noise, too many people. So the government and researchers are trying to figure out ways to limit the impact of all these tourists. And one solution is to create zoning where you have some areas where you let a lot of tourists go, some areas that are designated for backpacking or hiking, and other areas that are off limits. And this seems to be a promising strategy.
So three stories in this week's news section about the forests in China, Brazil, and the Democratic Republic of Congo.
So the three stories really point to the tension you have between the economics of people needing to make money, needing to clear land, and needing to preserve the forests. And it's a story that you hear over and over again. Like in almost every developing country, there is this tension and there is this problem of deforestation and there are these concerns and there are these government programs to try and address these concerns and they have mixed success. It's just fascinating to me that you hear the same story again and again and again, different points of time and different places.
Liz Panisi, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That's Science's Elizabeth Panisi. In addition to the three news stories Liz talked about, this week's Science also includes a review article and six perspectives on everything from forest dynamics to using forests to mitigate climate change, forests of the past, and the changing governance of the world's forests. Read the special section and watch a special online video presentation at www.sciencemag.org/forests. Deforestation happens everywhere, but does not affect all tree species equally. In this week's Science, Daniel Montoya and colleagues report in a paper that trees whose seeds were dispersed by animals rather than the wind actually showed a positive response to decreasing forest cover. The research implies that plant-animal interactions help prevent the collapse of forest communities under habitat destruction. I spoke with Montoya from his office at the Universidad de Alcalá in Madrid.
Well, our paper in Science deals with a long-standing issue in ecological theory. That is, do species differ in their response to habitat loss? Given that habitat loss is the leading cause of global biodiversity decline, providing an answer to this question is very important, and that's what motivated us to do this. We found that the interspecific differences among species in the response to habitat loss is strongly driven by the way a tree is dispersed. And basically, we find that animal dispersal conferred robustness to habitat loss. So this indicates that wind-dispersed species would be more vulnerable to habitat loss, and we should focus the conservation efforts on these species. But, of course, this is true only if the animal dispersers are present in the ecosystem. If they are not present, the animal dispersed species will be more vulnerable. So this highlights the importance of plant-animal interactions. No?
And previous researchers rarely looked at plants in looking at habitat destruction because perhaps it was assumed the habitat was plants?
Well, yeah, it's surprising. But normally most of the studies in this topic has been focused not on plants but on animals like birds and butterflies and at shorter scales. I think that the reason plants haven't been studied is that we are now having big data sets to test this hypothesis. And we are having now computational power to do this. And normally we lacked data on trees at large scales. So I think that's the most likely reason why plants have never been studied, at least at large scales, spatial scales, temporal scales, and many species.
And what about your temporal and spatial scale? What was that?
So what we see today is a result of a long previous habitat loss process, an historical one, occurring in the last decades or centuries, and in especially Mediterranean systems have been greatly human-impacted, and we have data on that.
So the data you looked at was from?
From Mediterranean Spain, from the Iberian Peninsula, excluding Portugal. So actually we have Mediterranean forests and Atlantic forests in the north of Spain, and we have up to 90,000 forest plots in the forest surface in Spain. That's a really big data set.
And out of that, how many tree species were you looking at?
Well, we focused on 34 species because they were the only ones we had really detailed data on. And they are very different species in ecological terms.
Of those 34 tree species, how did they respond?
To habitat loss. Well, most of them, habitat loss has a negative effect. Actually, we found statistical significance for 24 out of 34 species. There were another six species that we couldn't be sure that they had either negative or positive responses. And six of them, six out of 34 species, actually showed positive responses to habitat loss.
Why was that?
We didn't study deeply the reason why they show positive responses, but we can speculate that, for example, when habitat loss is occurring, habitat loss is removing the best competitors sometimes. And these species then increase in abundance because they don't find competitors. That's one possible mechanism. But actually, the six species showing positive responses are animal dispersed species. They are less impacted by habitat loss, partially caused by the way they disperse. Of course, animal dispersal has two main characteristics. One of them is that normally the seeds dispersed by animals are addressed to longer distances than wind dispersal. And the other characteristic is that animal dispersal is directed dispersal. This means that seeds are dispersed to suitable habitat. And suitable habitat in this sense means that they have a higher probability of survival. So these two characteristics make that from a tree perspective, a forest that is isolated, I mean many forest patches and places where the forest has been deforested, a tree will see these physically isolated patches as demographically connected. So that's why animal dispersal is increased robustness of tree species to habitat loss.
And to the wind dispersal trees?
Yeah. Wind dispersal normally is a random dispersal. So in a habitat loss context, they have a lower probability of survival, and so they are more impacted by habitat loss. And wind dispersal is addressed to shorter distances. So if there are two physically isolated forest patches, wind dispersal may not reach one patch from the other because of the distance.
So the implications here are that the plants that rely on animals are really going to be able to make it when there's some deforestation.
Well, not really. We find that they are less vulnerable, but there is still a significant interspecific difference within each dispersal group.
And what is that?
What is that? Well, we believe that there are other mechanisms operating there, like animal dispersed size, seed size, foraging behavior of animal dispersers. So there are many other mechanisms that are suggested in the scientific literature, but we didn't focus on these mechanisms. And they may be behind these interspecific differences within each dispersal group. But even within dispersal groups, we can say that, animal dispersed species are less vulnerable in general. But of course, habitat loss has an overall negative effect on species. And actually, species richness, which is the sum of all species, regardless of if they are wind dispersed or animal dispersed, decays with habitat loss. So most of the species have showed negative responses to deforestation, most of them. Just a few of them show positive responses. But most of them, habitat loss has an overall negative effect.
Daniel Montoya, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Daniel Montoya is lead author of a paper on the robustness of tree species to deforestation. Read the paper in this week's Science.
This is Nancy Goff, editor of Science Signaling. We are now accepting original research submissions for publication starting September 2008. The journal formerly known as Science's SDKE is devoted to the topic of cellular signal transduction. To learn more, go to www.sciencesignaling.org.
Some science jobs require you to get your hands dirty, but working in forest ecology also requires you to handle rain, heat, cold, insects, and be able to climb trees. As part of this week's special issue on forest ecology, Science Careers contributing editor Kate Travis talks to rainforest ecologist Catherine Cardalus about what it's like doing research up in the forest canopy.
Catherine Cardalus has been fascinated with tropical forests ever since taking a college class in plant biology. She made her first trip to the tropics the summer after graduating from college, when she volunteered on a research trip to La Selva Biological Station in northeastern Costa Rica.
For me, the second I walked into the tropics, it opened up everything that I think had been sitting back there latent, because it was just so diverse, so green, so lush, so absolutely fantastic. And so I was completely hooked.
Cardalus went on to get a PhD in tropical forest ecology from the University of Connecticut. She remembers that first trip to Costa Rica, particularly for one of the most valuable lessons she learned about doing research in the forest, how to climb a tree.
The first time I ever climbed a tree, it was my third day in the tropics. And this graduate student said, "Hey, Kat, you want to go climb a tree?" And I thought, sure, why not? So he helps me put on this harness, and I went up 15 meters, which is when I saw this whole seemingly miniature forest on top of all the branches. And I was stunned and loved it. And then I had to learn how to come down. So when I was already 15 meters up in the air is when he started yelling instructions on how to come down this rope. And so that was the first time. That was my only formal lesson in tree climbing.
Cardalus has climbed a lot of trees since that first trip in 1996. And still, she says every time she goes up in a new tree, it's a new experience.
One of the first things I notice is that the air changes. It's almost as though you've got this more humid understory, and as you're climbing up the branch, you have less humidity, and you start noticing the layers of the forest, and you start seeing more animals. And then you just slowly have changes in light levels, too. So it gets brighter and brighter and brighter, and so you're just under the canopy, and usually I climb emergent trees, which are actually the canopy trees that go above everybody else. And so there's this moment just before I get off onto the branches that I'm above all the other trees. And that is absolutely spectacular.
Now, Cardalus is finishing up her postdoc at the University of Florida, and she's about to start as an assistant professor at Colgate University. Her research focuses on plants called vascular epiphytes, which are plants that grow on other plants, such as orchids and bromeliads.
These are almost exclusively living on the tops of trees, and so very few people actually study them. And how these plants are distributed in space, and how their communities are structured, and how it's possible for so many plants to live in a place that doesn't have the vast resources of the forest floor soil is what I study.
And, of course, those studies involve surveying the plants in their natural environment.
I would go up and I would literally mark out 50-centimeter-long plots along branches and collect every individual in there and put it in a bag with a label and drop it down from the top of the tree. And then I identified every single individual I found. So I could get a real handle on what is the diversity up there, how does it change with elevation, and do we have really distinct communities?
She also studies what nutrients the epiphytes need to survive.
Normally, when you think about plant survival, you think of water, nutrients, and light. And there's really no light limitation on the canopy, but how do you get all the nutrients that you need up there? So I measured nutrients coming into the canopy from rainfall, from precipitation, and also collecting rainfall that has gone through the canopy layer, so it becomes throughfall. It actually changes in its chemistry. And I've measured the canopy soil to see what are the nutrients like up here? What do these plants have access to? And I'm looking on how they're specialized, so how these plants are actually able to deal with what seems as though really paltry supplies of nutrients.
Cardalus spent 2 straight years in Costa Rica during her PhD, followed by 2 6-month-long trips later during her dissertation research. And she spent 1 year there during her postdoc. She's passionate about her research, especially being in the field, or, in her case, up in the trees.
It's hard to compare sitting in the top of a rainforest to a desk. It's very hard because I think the best when I'm in the field. I'm convinced. I think that I'm most inspired at those moments. It's when you see it in action.
This spring, Cardalus will return to Costa Rica, and this time she plans to take students with her.
I've had some of my most rewarding experiences in the field mentoring students. I don't have as much classroom teaching time as I do field teaching time. It's a wonderful opportunity to be able to talk about the thing you're most passionate about and have people discover it.
Because fieldwork is such an important component of her job as a forest ecologist, Cardalus advises students interested in studying rainforests to do whatever they can to go there.
If you're interested in forest ecology, backpack down there, find a way to follow a graduate student around or a postdoc or a professor and literally go get your hands dirty. I've met many people, actually, who were convinced that they wanted to do tropical biology or forest ecology, and they go down to the tropics and they can't stand the bugs, or it's really too dirty or really too hot, or this just wasn't the right thing for them. So this is where you really need hands-on experience. You won't get enough from books because you need to be able to put on a backpack, be in huge downpours, I mean, just massive amounts of water, and keep your chin up and keep working and be incredibly flexible. Everything requires good question asking, good hypothesis testing, all these. But on top of it, you really just need to love it and to be able to handle that. We all find our niches.
And Cardalus leaves little doubt that she has found her niche in the tropical forest. For Science Careers, this is Kate Travis.
In a special section this week, contributing editor Elizabeth Payne writes about careers in forest ecology, and she profiles three young scientists in the field, including Catherine Cardalus. Find them in this week's Science and online at sciencecareers.org. Scientists have confirmed that the oldest seed ever to sprout is about 2,000 years old. In a paper in this week's Science, Sarah Salen and colleagues describe the germination, genetics, and growth of this ancient date seed. I spoke with Salen from her office at the Lewis Boreck Natural Medicine Research Center at the Hadassah Medical Organization in Jerusalem.
We succeeded in germinating an ancient date seed that was some 2,000 years old. It's the oldest seed ever to be grown, and that we have managed not only to germinate it, but also to grow it.
What were the characteristics of where the seed was found that you think allowed it to remain viable after all these years?
It's a difficult question, you know, because we don't really know. But first of all, Matsada, it was discovered at Matsada, is a fortress. And it's a fortress built by Heroid on the top of a mountain that overlooks the Dead Sea. And this area is interesting because the Dead Sea, you know, is the lowest point on Earth. And it's also extremely hot and dry there. So one of the things probably that helped conserve it was the extreme dryness and heat of this particular area.
How did you test the date of the seed?
Well, the date of the seed was done in two stages. First of all, we managed to get three seeds initially. And we took two seeds and chipped a little bit off them and sent those parts to the University of Zurich, Dr. Marcus Egli, who's in charge of the radiocarbon laboratory there. And they dated those two, what we call control seeds that were not put in the ground, as around 2,000 years old. The third seed, we didn't want to chip a piece off because we wanted to try and grow it. And we didn't really figure that cutting it in bits would help germinate it. So we just buried that, and that was done by Dr. Elaine Soloway, who prepared it beforehand and planted it. And when the came up, we had to wait about another 15 months until this seedling, which was then quite a reasonable height, was getting too big for its little pot. And then Dr. Soloway transferred that seedling into a bigger pot. And when she did it, tiny little fragments of the shell were clinging to the rootlets. She kept those fragments and sent them to me, and we sent them on again to Switzerland. And they dated them as a little bit younger than the control seeds. Why was there a difference of about 250 years? Because during its growth, the date had taken up what they call modern carbon, and that had affected the radiocarbon, the carbon-14 date of the fragments. So they made a calculation at the University of Zurich, and the amount of modern carbon was equivalent, is about 2%, we say in the paper, was equivalent to around 250, 300 years. And that brought us right back to the siege of Matsada 2,000 years ago. So that's how we did it.
How similar is the date palm that grew from this ancient seed to modern date plants?
Well, you know, it's not a question we can really answer. We can only say that Dr. Cohen, Yuval Cohen of the Volcani Institute, did very preliminary genetic analysis on the date, and he compared it with regular dates from Morocco, Egypt, and Iraq. These are the great date cultivated species today. And he found that there was about a 50% difference. That doesn't really tell us a lot at this stage because it's just one date. And it has characteristics of its mother and its father. And so as an individual, it would differ from other individuals, if you follow me. So we can't really say that it's 50% different from modern dates. We can just say that preliminary genetic analysis shows about 50% difference, but we need more ancient dates and genetic material from more germinated seeds before we can really say how different it is from modern dates.
It wouldn't be a matter of, say, reintroducing this plant into...
No. We'd need to get other ancient seeds, which we're trying to do, and we are persisting on this, so to try and grow other ancient dates from seeds. I think we could say that it's a botanical, archaeological, medical kind of mishmash of things, and we have people from all these disciplines helping us and contributing.
Why medical?
Well, my training is as a physician, and I'm by training a pediatric gastroenterologist. And for many, many years, I've worked at Hadassah as a pediatrician. But some years ago, I got very interested in natural medicines. You can call them alternative complementary medicine, but for us, they're natural medicines, meaning they're not drug or chemical-based. Medicines particularly that are derived from plant and natural sources. So with the help of our kind benefactor, Lewis Borick, we set up the Lewis Borick Natural Medicine Research Center. And we research medicinal plants. And one of the things that we do is not just research medicinal plants, particularly of this area, but we also cultivate them, domesticate them, conserve them, and try and preserve and protect the ancient knowledge about how those plants were used. And we try to reintroduce those plants back into the environment. So we're interested not only in the plants that grow in the Middle East now, but also the ones that used to grow here, like the ancient date, which was known in history not only as a source of delicious dates and a very important food, but also as a medicine, strangely enough, as a treatment, particularly for pulmonary lung infections. Tuberculosis is mentioned in ancient sources as a treatment for cancer, for tumors, as an antibiotic. It had many, many uses.
Well, Sarah Salen, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Rob, very much for the interview.
Sarah Salen is lead author of a paper on the germination genetics and growth of an ancient date seed. Read the paper in this week's Science. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest in forestry news. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So I understand you've got a forest story in this week's Science Now.
That we do, Rob. And this story is actually about the temperature of tree leaves. And scientists have found that no matter how cold it gets outside where a tree is growing, its leaves always stay at a balmy 21.4 degrees Celsius.
That seems pretty surprising that cold trees would have warm leaves.
It is surprising because from what we know of trees, they tend to be pretty passive. Scientists had always assumed when it got hot outside, trees would get hot, and when it got cold outside, trees would get cold. So a team of researchers looked at the ratio of different oxygen isotopes in a variety of samples from trees from all over the world, those that grow in cold climates and those that grow in warm climates. And they looked at two specific isotopes of oxygen. One is called oxygen 18 and one's called oxygen 16. And they measured the ratio of one to the other. And why they focused on these isotopes is oxygen 18 tends to be more plentiful in plants when they're grown in warmer climates. And the researchers also looked at trees that were close to weather stations. So they had very accurate readings of how hot or cold the weather was throughout the year. And the really surprising thing that they found was that even in really cold climates where the average annual temperature is as cold as 10 degrees below zero, the leaves of these trees are still staying quite warm, around 21.4 degrees Celsius.
Do the researchers know how these leaves are staying warm?
Well, the researchers don't think that the trees are actually generating the heat themselves or that the leaves are coated with some sort of super insulating material that's keeping them warm. Rather, they think that the trees evolved in such a way that the leaves are clumped together in a way that they trap still air. And this serves as a sort of blanket for the leaves that would keep them warmer than the outside temperature.
Well, what are other researchers saying about this?
Well, Rob, as you might expect, because it's such a surprising finding, it's a bit of a controversial study. In fact, one researcher says that one of the flaws he finds in the study is that the team assumes that just because some of these northern trees grow in climates where the average temperature is 10 below zero, that that's what temperature the leaves are growing in. But in fact, a lot of these leaves grow at different times of the year when the temperature is warmer and during warm parts of the day. So the leaves might not actually be insulating themselves from the cold and be warming themselves up, but they may just be growing when temperatures are warmer.
So they're only the 21.4 degrees Celsius when they're actually growing.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now?
You mean non-forest stories, Rob?
I suppose so, Dave.
Well, I've got a few for you. We're looking into a couple stories that involve brain scans, one that shows what happens in the brains of tune-deaf people when they hear a sour note. And these are normally people that can't distinguish between a song that's played properly and a song that's played poorly. And researchers are learning a little bit more about what's going on in their brains. Another brain scan story that shows what happens in our brains when we lose possessions. And finally, a story about high-altitude adaptation. Some populations of people deal much better with high altitudes than others, and scientists are starting to figure out why. So be sure to check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science stories at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the June 13th, 2008 special science podcast on forests. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.